President, authorities say all necessary steps have been taken for having a safe and secure vote on Friday. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to get fully prepared for confrontation with the US in order to protect the dignity of the country. Also ahead, Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters marching in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against a controversial settlers' rally. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. We're going to kick off this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. Iranians will go to the polls on Friday to choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. More than 59 million people are eligible to cast their ballots in the country's 13th presidential election. The minimum voting age in Iran is 18. The opening and closing times for polling locations inside Iran are 7 a.m. to midnight and can be subjected to a two-hour extension. There will be 67,000 polling stations across Iran, as well as more than 230 in other countries for expatriate voters. The spokesman for Iran's Constitutional Council has held a press conference in Tehran to elaborate on the upcoming presidential election slated for June 18. Yusuf Jalali reports from the press's venue.
The Constitutional Council, which vets the nominees and oversees the election, held a presser to elaborate on the upcoming vote and to take questions from Iranian and international media. The majority of the questions focused on the vetting procedure. In this election, many heavyweight hopefuls from both the reformist and principalist camps were not approved by the council.
The Constitutional Council works based on Articles 150 and 110 of Iran's constitution and the election law that is passed by the parliament. The conditions that are stipulated in those articles are our criteria for qualifying or disqualifying a candidate. The results are then put into a vote, and the council members will discuss whether to approve or disapprove of a nominee.
Out of 592 hopefuls who signed up for the race, the Constitutional Council approved 7 nominees. At the last minute, 3 candidates stepped out of the race. Mohsen Mehralizadeh withdrew in favor of the now only reformist runner, Abdel Nasser Hemati. Saeed Jalili and Ali Reza Zarqani dropped out to rally behind Sayed Ibrahim Raisi, the sitting judiciary chief and the flag bearer of the principalist camp. Asked about the criteria for approving the candidates, the Constitutional Council's spokesman said the watchdog body is impartial with regards to the candidates' political affiliation.
The Constitutional Council has never vetted the nominees based on their political approach. Previous elections and the current one attest to our impartiality in reviewing the qualification of the candidates. Even in this election, you can see contenders from different political backgrounds and with different approaches running.
Amid the coronavirus pandemic, the election is being held with strict health protocols in effect. Campaigning was also conducted with limited rallying, and candidates instead campaigned through televised speeches and debates. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president. The Constitutional Council says it vetted the candidates based on Iran's constitution and did not apply any personal considerations in the process. All in all, this time the election was not a clash of political parties, but a contest of policies. Policies that offer the best cure for the ailing Iranian economy. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iranians living abroad will also be able to cast their ballots in the country's 13th presidential election on Friday. The following report takes a look on how the voting will be held in Iranian embassies and missions across the globe.
The 13th presidential election in the Islamic Republic of Iran will be held on Friday. With the voting just one day away, Iran's Interior Ministry and the Election Commission have made all the necessary preparations for the big day. Over 59 million people are eligible to vote in the June 18th election. But the election will not just be held in Iran. Iranian expats will also be able to vote. According to Iran's constitution, All Iranians, regardless of where they live, should have access to polling stations to cast their ballots. Iranian presidential elections have always been held across the globe by the Foreign Ministry. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the ministry has election headquarters as well as monitoring missions outside Iran. He said there are 3.5 million Iranians eligible to vote outside Iran for the upcoming election. Khatibzadeh said the Foreign Ministry began the preparations for holding elections 6 months ago and issued a memo to all Iranian embassies and missions in the world in this regard. He said 133 Iranian missions with 234 polling stations will hold the presidential election this Friday. Khatibzadeh said there will be at least one polling station in every country where Iran has a mission. He said this includes 5 polling stations in the UK and 5 polling stations in Germany. The spokesman noted that even in the United States, to which Iran does not have any diplomatic ties, Iranians will be able to vote. He said there will be polling stations in 24 U.S. states, including Arizona, Georgia, and Maryland. Khatibzadeh, however, said the voting will not take place in 3 countries, most importantly, Canada.
In 3 countries, voting for this year's presidential election will not be held, the most important of which is Canada. The Canadian government did not cooperate with us in the last presidential election either. Even when we had diplomatic ties, Canada sought to hamper the election process and did not allow the voting to be held in any city other than Ottawa. In other cities that there are a significant number of Iranians like Vancouver, Montreal, and Edmonton, no voting took place. Unfortunately, the Canadian government still refuses to allow voting for this election. Iran's mission at the UN discussed the issue with the Canadian mission. We have also sent a memo to the Canadian government in this regard, but so far the Canadian government has refused to do so, so the vote will not be held in Canada.
Now, Iran's chief negotiator Abbas Araghchi says talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement have come closer than ever to fruition. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Araghchi noted that some essential issues are still being negotiated. He said Tehran wants to make sure that the United States will not repeat its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Iran. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his U.S. counterpart that he expects Washington to fully return to the accord known as the JCPOA. Iran, along with the European Union and 6 world powers, thrashed out the landmark agreement in 2015 after years of negotiations. However, the US pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. Tehran says it wants all sanctions removed in a verifiable manner. Political commentator David Yerubian says the Biden administration needs a foreign policy win by reviving the JCPOA.
Well, the Biden administration needs this. It needs a foreign policy win, if you will. And this is because it has essentially doubled down on all of the failed foreign policy initiatives of the Trump administration, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Syria, it's Israel policy. It's aggression towards Russia and China. And I believe that this is how it links to the G7 conference, irrespective of any positive commentary related to the exchange between Putin and Biden. The United States made it clear at the G7 that Russia is to be perceived and treated as a threat and China as a challenge. And so in that context, the United States desperately needs a foreign policy win, if you will, and if not a win, just to take the Iran issue off the table for American foreign policy elites so they can focus on this new Cold War 2.0 that they're trumpeting against Russia and China.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with the United States under President Joe Biden. In remarks during the meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, Kim outlined his strategy for relations with Washington. He stressed that Pyongyang needs to get fully prepared for confrontation in order to protect the dignity of the country. North Korea has already accused Biden of pursuing a, quote, hostile policy. Biden's predecessor Donald Trump made headlines but little diplomatic progress with a series of face-to-face meetings with Kim. Biden says he will not pursue that policy unless North Korea negotiates its nuclear arsenal with a concrete plan. Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, arresting a number of people. Palestinians were protesting outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound against a controversial march by Israeli settlers on Tuesday. During the march, Israeli settlers insulted Islam's Prophet Muhammad and chanted death to Arabs under the protection of Israeli forces. The so-called March of Flag also triggered protests in the Gaza Strip, where resistance groups warned the regime of consequences for allowing such a controversial move. Israel, meanwhile, has carried out airstrikes on the besieged of the Gaza Strip, hitting at least 10 Palestinian targets near the cities of Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun. No casualties have been reported so far. Tel Aviv claims the air raids were in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons towards the occupied territories. Also, Palestinian resistance groups have shot down and seized an Israeli drone in the west of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli strikes followed Israel's 11-day aggression against Gaza last month. The conflict ended on May 20.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we now go over to Press TV headquarters here in Tehran for a discussion with Professor Alexander Azadegan, a discussion about the 13th presidential election currently underway here in the Islamic Republic. Let's go over.
Some of them are criticizing the elections. And when you dig deeper, you see that the source of their information is not only disinformation, I would say misinformation, but I'm going to say disinformation because it's not entirely inaccurate. And the second aspect is the source of their information comes from a terrorist organization, the MKO.
Good to be with you, Rustam. Yes, this is what I was discussing with Daniel yesterday. We had an interview. The terrorist organization that you're mentioning, MKO, formerly used to be based in Iraq until the change in the system in Iraq, and they were kicked out. They were mercenaries for Saddam Hussein. They not only turned against their own people, they are responsible for 17,000 deaths within Iran. I'm actually involved with an organization, an Iranian UN-recognized NGO called ADBT. And not only were they responsible for the murdering of Iranians, they also did Saddam Hussein's bidding in killing the Shias and the Kurds and the Sunnis who rose up to challenge Saddam Hussein. So they are as ugly and as immoral and as vile and as evil as it gets. Their operational headquarters right now is in Albania. I saw pictures of their cyberspace command. It was a bunch of old men and women who were sitting there and then trying to spread falsehood through social media. And their political wing is in France. Why that is not objected to by Iranians during the negotiations is beyond me. How can a terrorist organization be based in Paris, their political wing, and that fact is not brought down to the attention of the global audience? I'm sure within the diplomatic circles that has been brought up. The reason this terrorist group is causing a lot of noise these days, besides the fact that they were taken out of the terrorist list by EU and US, which in and out of itself is a travesty because they were responsible for the murder of two American military personnel before the revolution. How and why they were taken out of that list is beyond amazing, but the reason they're creating a lot of noise is that they're citing what happened in Iran in 1988, right after the end of the Iran-Iraq war. What happened with them is that they broke the ceasefire. Saddam Hussein unleashed these people. They attacked Iran when the Iranians were battle-worn, they were battle-fatigued, they thought there's a ceasefire, and they attacked. The operation is known as Operation Mursad. That's what Iran calls it. They, in their own propaganda, call it Operation Furugh Javadan in Persian. But they were beaten heavily from the ground and from the air. And a judicial decision was made in 1988 to implement justice against them. And at that time, Mr. Raisi had a key role, as he always has had, in the judiciary. And so that's why they're sort of bringing this to the attention of the, mercenary Persian-speaking media. Unfortunately, it's not just Al Arabiya, it's all these other channels that I'm not going to mention that are based in the UK. They're based in London, actually. And plus VOA over in Washington. Plus this radio that I'm not going to mention their name, but their headquarters is out of Prague, Czech Republic. So they're spewing a lot of hate and falsehoods. When you are in the position of the judiciary, you have to make tough decisions. I'm not sitting here defending the decision that was made, but it was a decision that was made by the judiciary and the Iranian system to implement justice against these people. They are still very active in Iran. They get their cues from Mossad. They are the operational wing of Mossad in Iran. Of course, they're Persian speaking, and every misinformation about the Iranian nuclear activity was sort of falsified by these people to the so-called global community, an international community. So they are a force to be reckoned with, but from a political perspective within Iran, they are loathed. They are absolutely hated. They have no future whatsoever if the Iranian system for some reason collapses. They have no future because the Iranian people have judged them since the beginning, since they actually joined Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war, or better put, during the Saddam Hussein imposed war. They got must power, and Israel is behind them. So is the European Union, shamefully, and most of all Washington. So that's what this is all about. It's trying to propagandize a judicial decision that was made in 1988 with the assistance and quite possibly the supervision of Mr. Raisi, who's projected and forecasted to win this election. So they're trying to sort of muddy the water. The second point that I will mention very briefly is that what moral credibility does Saudi Arabia or any of these oil-rich Persian Gulf dictatorships have to talk about democracy? The last time they had democracy in the Arabian Peninsula is when they collected a member from each tribe to assassinate Prophet Muhammad. That's the last time they had a democracy. They don't even have a parliament in Saudi Arabia. And these are very medieval type of monarchy systems. There are Bahrain comes to mind. They are extremely brutal when it comes to shutting down human rights and freedom and liberty and expression, just basically expression of freedom, political perspectives. So now they're out there trying to talk about democracy and fooling the global media, especially, and unfortunately, the Persian-speaking audiences who still watch those bogus channels.
Alexander, hold that thought, Alexander. I'll get back to you on that. Just hold that thought for a second. Let me bring in Tim Anderson, who's waiting for us. Tim Anderson, thank you for your patience. He's the director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us out of Sydney. Tim, what's your initial thoughts on the 13th presidential election? Just give us your thoughts first on that.
Thank you. Well, I think one of the most important things is the turnout today and the level of participation, which the more serious outside analysts are pointing to an indicator of the health of the democracy, of Iran's democracy, I suppose. And of course, it's mitigated by factors like the fact that the epidemic is still raging. It's declining, but I'm sure there's still a great deal of concern about that there. So I think the turnout today is one of the most going to be one of the most important features.
Right. Now, Tim, there's some complaints from, you've got some regional monarchies in the Persian Gulf that are criticizing Iran for holding elections. But I don't know, give us, what do you think about the people of those kingdoms? Would they want some sort of form of elections? To hear the sound of ballot boxes and the vetting process and the candidates? Those words don't even appear in the terminology of such kingdoms and monarchies and dictatorships that just happen to be the strongest allies of the United States.
Actually, I haven't been paying much attention to what the monarchies are saying about Iran's democracy. I mean, Iran is well ahead of many Western countries in its democracy, let alone the Arab monarchies of the Gulf there. Of course, notable that none of those regimes were touched by the so-called Arab Spring of 10 years ago. But I wouldn't pay much attention to what Saudi Arabia or the Emirates or Kuwait or Bahrain or the others say about that. There is some analysis coming.
Some will say they were touched, but they were crushed.
Well, in Bahrain, that's true. There was an uprising which was crushed, yeah. But what I meant to say was that you know, there wasn't any Western propaganda about the need for democracy in those Arab states with the least of all democracy. Having said that, going back to your question, there is a certain amount of coverage from Al Jazeera, which has been rather toxic in other parts of the region, but for reasons we're all familiar with, in the last 4 years, there's been a more moderate coverage from Qatar's media giant, let's say, in relation to Iran. So there's a bit more sensible reporting coming from Qatar's media about the elections.
Okay, let me get back to Alexander. Alexander, you were speaking about the. We were talking about the terrorist groups and the media, the mainstream media, who are getting their sources from. When you see the sources, they just go back to a terrorist organization. That was a terrorist organization even under the United States terrorist list until it decided to delist it one day. But for organizations like the MKO terrorist group and their friends, Bolton and Pompeo and the likes, today must be like the worst time of the year for them.
Well, it is. Iranian election by no means is perfect because no election is really perfect. We could sit here and have an academic discussion about the role of the Guardian Council, but this is not the forum for it. To use Donald Trump's expression, we will do those in our own big, beautiful Iranian think tanks, and we will try to come to some conclusion of how things could be positively reformed. But, you know, it shows the absolute desperation of dictatorships like the Saudi regime that have been occupying the Arabian Peninsula since 1932. Here's a country that's not even 100 years old, and they dare think that they could dictate to Iran, a civilization of 7,000 years old. And their country was practically put together by one-star general and a psychological operation, MI6, the agent, who happened to be a bisexual. I intentionally want to mention that because they have no credibility. All they have is money, and they are the cash cow of global powers, all global powers, by the way, not just the Europeans. Russians sell them weapons too, and that's really all they are. And we have seen their schizophrenic foreign policy. We have heard how Mohammed bin Salman, the so-called prince, more like the butcher, how he actually pulled the 180 in the past several weeks in his reconciliatory approach toward Iran, which we welcome. But it only shows how lost they are. They lost in Iraq. They lost in Syria. They are losing in Yemen. And these are all pet projects of this so-called crown prince. So they are so desperate that they have to, like you were saying, they have to actually use the citation of a terrorist group. But they're diversifying. They're not putting all their eggs in one basket. They're also diversifying with the fossilized monarchists that were toppled in 1979. Saudi Arabia has a Persian-speaking channel. I'm not going to mention their name, obviously, but they're based in London. Their funding comes directly from Mohammed bin Salman. One of Mohammed bin Salman's senior advisors is the editor, is the chief editor for this channel. And those of you, those of our audience who speak Persian, that I'm sure they've heard of this channel, it's laughable, Weston, when you watch this. It's absolutely laughable, the amount of lying, the amount of deception, the propaganda, the psychological warfare.
Okay, and, Alexander.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you short. Let me, because we're running out of time, let me give the last word to Tim. Tim, how much of a blow is today's elections in Iran? How much of a blow is that to America's hegemonic plots in the region?
Oh, I think that's very important. It's very important, just as the election, the recent elections in Syria were very important, that they demonstrate that the independent countries of the region, and Iran being the leading independent country of the region, are proceeding regardless of the multiple wars that have been carried on around them for the last 20 years. And these countries are surviving and developing their own systems, including their political systems. I think that's very important. It's an important vindication of Iran's independence, and as the leader of the independent countries of the region, it's something that really the Israeli leadership and the leadership in Washington is going to be quite worried about and having to reassess their plans.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution and your time. Let me thank our guests, Alexander Azadegan, the professor and the senior geopolitical advisor, joining us from Irvine, and also Tim Anderson, director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us out of Sydney. Dear viewers, thank you for staying tuned. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in about 3 minutes' time with our next bulletin, and over the course of the next few hours, we will be covering Iran's presidential election.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, you've just listened to a live roundtable discussion with Tim Anderson from Sydney, Australia, and Alexander Azadegan, a professor, a political analyst, talking from Irvine, California. They were discussing the 13th presidential election in Iran and what it means for the wider region, and also its effects on U.S. interests and U.S. policies in West Asia region. So that was the live roundtable discussion with Alexander Azadegan and Tim Anderson. Okay, we now go over to our regular programming here in Tehran.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests and friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. I am Sister Nasreen, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so very much, Sister Nasreen. Although your accent makes it quite obvious, just for, you know, our listeners to get more in tune with the vibe of our discussion. Can I ask where you're from and what you've your studies have been?
I'm born in England, and I am studying Masters in Philosophy of Ethics.
MashaAllah. Thank you so
Applied
very
ethics,
much.
Actually.
Thank you so much for that information. And my other lovely guest is...
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I'm studying here in the holy city of Qom, studying Islam, and I'm at your service today.
Awesomeness. A joy and a pleasure, you guys. Thank you so very much for joining me on today's discussion. Today we're going to be talking about something that, you know, because of certain ahadith, I feel like Muslims shy away from addressing it, from chasing it, from inspiring toward it. Like ahadith that's, especially from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where he says, beware of tul al-amal, like far-fetched dreams. Or a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, where his eminence says, I fear for two things for my ummah after me, one of which is tul al-amal, again, far-fetched dreams. And today we want to talk about dreams of Muslims. Like, as a Muslim person, what kind of dreams and goals do we have? And whether the word dream is even appropriate to be used in this context.
Jazakallah for that. Yeah, no, you did a really good job, because you introduced one of the main ideas here, which is fundamental to this discussion, which is this idea of having, you know, tulul amal, and people would translate it as having like fake dreams, you know, these hollow, shallow dreams. I'm going to become this, I'm going to do this in the future. Actually, perhaps a more appropriate translation would be far-fetched hopes. That's what they're really talking about, right? Far-fetched hopes. One day I'll become a good Muslim. One day I'll do this, right? It's a complete fantasy. Complete fantasy. Why do I say that?
Why do you
Because
say that?
The present is all that exists, sister.
True.
This is all we have, right? The past is history. The future is a mystery. Today is a gift.
That's
why they call it a present.
Did you just quote Kung Fu Panda on this extremely serious show?
But there's a wisdom behind it, right? And that's the reality. Now, dreams are a different thing now. To have dreams, and we're not talking about the types of dreams that you have when you're sleeping, you know, nightmares, and you dream about, I don't know, my brother had a dream that a carrot was chasing him, and he woke up in cold sweats. You know, we're not talking about those kinds of dreams. We're talking about having a dream. You know, having a dream that the world could be a better place.
No, you remind me of someone.
The Martin Luther Jr.
Exactly.
I have a dream.
All right, thank you so much. Sister Nasreen, what is your opinion on this matter of Muslims having dreams? Or how do you define?
I agree.
Really?
I agree with him. No, I mean, this is basically, if someone is a practicing Muslim and goes back to the core values of Islam, then our dream is something within, like, my dream is that my child becomes a living example for the living imam. You know, the dreams should center around something of reality, and that you work towards those day by day. But we should never sort of have something in the future that is not connected to our behavior today. And it should be a transformational type of, you know, it's dangerous to use the wrong word, ambition,
definitely.
I suppose. You see, Islam is something that goes back always to development of the self, and eventually goes to the physique, but we won't go into that. But the way that we tend to see things is because is the way that we have been influenced by the secular thinking, which is something outside the self.
For sure.
You know, like a big house. Okay.
This is
something
that
sort of detracts us from what our actual mission in life, our creation, is for. You know, what we've been created for.
God. All right, just to...
So I agree.
All right. All right, in conclusion, we agree. We agree with the fact that طول الأمل, not cool, having far-fetched dreams and hopes, because all we have is now, the present time, the today. And there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that says exactly that. Don't grieve about your yesterday, it's already gone. Don't worry about tomorrow, it may never come. All you have is today, right? And then the next point is that to define dreams and goals and ambitions in an Islamic context, we'd say something that a development process that happens inside me rather than something that's actualized outside of me, like a house or a status or money or zeros in my bank account. But I feel that since we are material beings, unfortunately, I wish we weren't, because, you know, now things...
There would be no challenge.
Everything
an angel,
is just
then.
So complicated now. Mm. We still have, as Muslims, things that we want to see happen in the outside world that makes us feel fulfilled and successful and achieved.
Explain that, please.
Okay.
Let me hold in. Explain why you think that an outside thing can fulfill an inside.
Oh, because, no, in a emphasis on a Muslim person. A Muslim person, I'm thinking about a person who already has Islamic values and Islamic criteria and Islamic standards in their lives. Their ambition is toward gaining things that will help them become a better Muslim, right? And naturally, because they have that material aspect of them going on, there are material things that would act as a means to help achieve that goal, right? Mm-hmm. If I have a certain degree of money, I don't actually always have to be grappling with crippling poverty. If I have a certain degree of money where I can live an exceptionally good life and help others as well, if I can reach a certain academic degree to empower my Islamic society, my Islamic brothers and sisters.
Islamic academic degree is an inward dream, not an outward.
Don't you think it's both, though?
No.
I think it's both, yeah.
It's an you're getting a sort of certificate or recognition that you have achieved an inward.
Yeah, but it manifests outwards anyways. It's not like so many other inward things. So, Brother Muzaffar, how would you say, with that said, what sort of dreams and goals do you think as a Muslim you have, or you think other Muslims have had, or we should be, you know, we should be ambitious toward?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So let's just categorize it very quickly. There's two types of dreams, basically, right?
Thank you, yeah.
One for the dunya, one for the akhirah. All right. So dunyawi dreams, you know, I want a big house, I want to be rich, I want to be famous, I want this and that and this and that. They're all materialistic things. They'll never make you happy at the end of the day. Even if a person has a mountain of gold, he'll want another mountain of gold to add to it. That it'll never ever satisfy you. This dunya is like seawater, according to our hadith. The more you drink, the thirstier you'll get. Eventually, you will die.
Very nice.
It sounds bleak.
No, it's a very...
And you're like, eventually, you will die.
Potent.
You will die. That's it. All right. Well done. You got your dunya, and there you are. You're an old man, and you're dead. There's a really interesting story, actually. There was this guy, really, really, like, you know, basic guy. He lived in the village, and like, away from technology and stuff, completely separated from modern society. And a capitalist comes to him, and he goes... He sees this guy, and he's in his boat, and he's catching a fish in the scenic kind of, you know, village, and there's like a lake there. It's all beautiful. He's catching a fish. The capitalist says to him, "Why are you doing this?" He goes, "So that I can feed my family." Mm. He goes, "Well, why don't you sell the fish instead?" The guy goes, "Why? Because then if you sell the fish, you could tomorrow, you know, buy two boats and employ somebody to go and catch fish with you." And then he goes, why? And then he goes, so that then you can get a company established in your name eventually, and then that company will churn out fish and sell it internationally. He goes, why? Because eventually you can retire. And then he goes, why would I want to retire? And he goes, so that you can relax and catch fish. He goes, right.
Exactly.
You know, it brings us right back to this discussion of living in the here and now. Now, these are dunyawi dreams. There are real, true dreams that we can have, that we can aspire to, which will help our akhirah. What is a man? Since I'm sitting here with two sisters, what is a human except one who tries to make the world a better place, right?
Whole idea of making the world a better place entails a lot of investing into the future.
Of course. You need to... It's incredible how much of Islam focuses our attention on عَمِلُ الصَّالِحَاتِ, doing good deeds. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. It continuously repeats
that
this.
That is the investment.
It's about believing and doing action. The action part is often missing. You believe that you can accomplish certain things, but then you don't set out to do them. And the Qur'an will actually help us to get connected to accomplishing those great dreams. Now, one verse that I'd like to highlight here is one of my favorite verses. إِن تَنْصُرُ اللَّهَ يَنْصُرْكُمْ. If you help Allah, He will help you. Now, you have to believe in that. If your dream is to do something which Allah wants to have accomplished on the earth, you will have His help in doing it. And another verse is, when you've made your decision, trust in Allah. All right, you have
that's
to
very,
make
that's
your
a
decision.
That's a very important point,
you know?
Yes.
Believe in that decision now and just trust in Allah. He will help you get there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I think I wanted to, although it deserves some input, but just because of the time, I'll go on to add what I wanted to add, that, you know, something practical for people that, you know, they're maybe confused about this situation and when to sort of focus on a dream versus focusing on an action or behavior. You know, like, for example, when you're selecting a spouse, there's this expectation aspect that is the killer. You know, when you go into a marriage for expectations rather than how can I perform if I am to choose this spouse? Am I able to perform my duties with this kind of spouse? And how can I contribute? How can I, you know, bring my talents and my personality into it? As opposed to, what am I expecting to gain out of this union? And I think if we can distinguish in our minds or in our heart, how are we making sort of decisions? How are we making our dreams? Is it a selfish dream or is it a communal dream that will end in the goal that every Shia today should have and is created for in this time is for the reappearance of our Imam. That is our ultimate and should be our only focus and dream today. How can this selection process that we're going through that we had in our last program help me towards this goal?
I'm so glad the conversation came to this because I feel that basically sums up every dream and goal and ambition a Muslim Shia especially could have. It's the definition of making the world a better place. It is the epitome of becoming a better person. It is the person. It is the actualization, planning for the future, right? It brings everything together. This whole concept of preparing the world and creating the groundwork for the reappearance of Al-Hujjah alayhi salam brings everything together. Thank you so very much, you guys, for your opinions and your input. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Back to Reality. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا التي ما رايزك لتصي دايلايتك وانسك.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, FBI is Pursuing Hundreds in Capitol Riot Inquiry, Ray Tells Congress. FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault on Congress one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. We've already arrested close to 500, and we have hundreds of investigations that are still ongoing beyond those 500, Christopher A. Wray, FBI's Director General, told the House Oversight Committee. Christopher Wray's assurances of how seriously the agency was taking the attack by a pro-Trump mob came as lawmakers pressed him and military commanders on why they did not do more to prevent the siege, despite threats from extremists to commit violence. The threats, I would say, were everywhere, said Representative Carolyn Maloney, a New York Democrat who's the chairwoman of the House Oversight Committee. The system was blinking red. Representative Caroline Maloney confronted FBI Director Christopher Wray with messages from the social media site Parler, which she said referred to threats of violence to the FBI more than 50 times before the attack on 6th of January. One message which Ms. Maloney said Parler had sent to an FBI liaison officer on 2nd of January was from a poster who warned, "Don't be surprised if we take the Capitol building, and Trump needs us to cause chaos to enact the Insurrection Act." "I do not recall hearing about this particular email," Christopher Wray replied. "I'm not aware of Parler ever trying to contact my office." In hearings before two congressional committees on Tuesday, 15th of June, lawmakers sought new information about the security failures that helped lead to the violence. At one hearing, Caroline Maloney presented her committee's research into the delayed response of the National Guard, which showed that the Capitol Police and Washington officials made 12 urgent requests for their support, and that Army leaders told the National Guard to stand by 5 times as the violence escalated. "That response took far too long," Caroline Maloney said. "This is a shocking failure." Documents obtained by the committee showed that beginning at 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, top officials at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, received pleas for help from the Capitol Police Chief, Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington, and other officials. But the National Guard did not arrive until 5:20 p.m., more than 4 hours later, after the Capitol perimeter had been breached. The National Guard was literally waiting, all ready to go, and they didn't receive the green light for a critical time period, hours on end, said Representative Rohana, a Democrat of California and a member of the House Oversight Committee. Lawmakers had tough questions for General Charles Flynn, who commands the U.S. Army Pacific, and Lieutenant General Walter E. Piatt, the director of the Army staff, both of whom were involved in a key phone call with police leaders during the riot, in which Army officials worried aloud about the optics of sending in the National Guard. According to those involved, it was the first time lawmakers had heard from either general. In their testimony, they described a frantic call in which the chief of the Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police became agitated as they tried unsuccessfully to get military support whilst rioters attacked their officers at the Capitol building. "Both speakers on the phone sounded highly agitated and even panicked," General Flynn recalled. By contrast, he said, "General Piatt was a calm and combat-experienced leader." General Piatt has defended his caution in initially advising against sending in the National Guard, telling the committee that he was definitely concerned in the days before 6th of January about the public perception of using soldiers to secure the election process in any manner that could be viewed as political. He told the committee that the National Guard forces were not trained, prepared, or equipped to conduct this type of law enforcement operation. "When people's lives are on the line, 2 minutes is too long," General Piatt said. "But we were not positioned for that urgent request. We had to re-prepare so we would send them in prepared for this new mission." General Flynn is the brother of Michael Flynn, President Donald Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, who has emerged as one of the former president's biggest promoters of the lie of a stolen election. In submitted testimony, General Flynn said he had not participated in the call, but merely overheard portions of it when he entered the room whilst it was in progress. He said that he had not heard any discussion of political considerations with regards to sending in the National Guard. "I did not use the word optics, nor did I hear the word used during the call on 6th of January 2021, he said. The panel did not hear testimony from the acting chief of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman, who declined to attend, citing her need to hear testimony at the other hearing before the House Administration Committee. Republicans were quick to criticize her decision and repeatedly referred to her absence during the session, which stretched into the evening. Representative Caroline Maloney said she was also disappointed, but she added that Police Chief Pittman had committed to testifying on 21st of July. In a simultaneous session on Tuesday afternoon, the House Administration Committee heard testimony from Michael Bolton, the Capitol Police Inspector General, and Greta Goodwin, the Director of Homeland Security and Justice for the Government Accountability Office. Michael Bolton testified about his fourth investigative report into the failures of 6th of January, which found that the department's tactical unit did not have access to adequate training facilities or adequate policies in place for securing ballistic helmets and vests. 24 were stolen during the riot. The agency's first responder unit was also not equipped with adequate, less lethal weapons, among other findings. Michael Bolton's reports found that the Capitol Police had clearer warnings about the riot than were previously known, including the potential for violence in which Congress itself is a target. He also revealed that police officers were instructed by their leaders not to use their most aggressive tactics to hold off the mob, in part because they feared that they lacked the training to handle the equipment needed to do so. About 140 police officers were injured during the attack on 6th of January, and 7 people died in connection with the siege, including one police officer who had multiple strokes after sparring with rioters.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first to cast his